In the grim darkness of the far future, the Emperor's mighty space marines are celebrated as humanity's greatest protectors. They are the legendary Angels of Death, towering genetically engineered warriors who descend from the skies to deliver mankind from ravenous aliens, heretics, and worse. But for all their devotion to defending humanity, space marines are not kindly guardian angels. To the common people of the Imperium, they can be saviors one moment and terrifying, indifferent giants the next. How do these superhuman soldiers truly treat the ordinary humans they fight for? The answer is as complex and uncompromising as the Warhammer 40,000 universe itself. What follows is a sobering look, part grim observation, part dark sarcasm, at the relationship between the Adeptus Astartes and the people they ostensibly protect. Short answer, brutally. But let's delve deeper. In this documentary-style exploration, we'll see that some Space Marine chapters hold genuine, if hard-edged, respect and compassion for ordinary folk, while others view them as disposable pawns in a vast galactic war. We'll witness how a Space Marine's duty to humanity often demands sacrifices of humanity, and why being saved by an Angel of Death can be as frightening as being attacked by the enemy. Welcome to the grim reality of life and death, under the protection of the Adeptus Astarte, transhuman guardians of humanity. Space Marines are not ordinary soldiers. They are transhuman war machines, shaped solely for battle. Standing 8 feet tall in heavy ceramite power armor, a single Astartes can wield firepower and strength that entire squads of mortal troops cannot match. They were created by the Emperor of Mankind to defend humanity, yes, but they themselves are barely human anymore. From childhood, they are taken and altered with gene seed organs, clad in nearly invulnerable armor, indoctrinated in war and loyalty. They feel little fear, no exhaustion, and exist only to destroy the enemies of the Imperium. This fundamental difference colors every interaction they have with normal humans. To a civilian in a hab block or a farmer on some distant agri-world, a space marine is a figure out of myth. They are often called the Emperor's angels, immortal knights descending from the heavens in thunderous dropyards. Children might pray to catch a glimpse of the noble ultramarines parading through a city, or to be saved by space wolves charging in with bolters blazing. But encountering a space marine in the flesh is exceedingly rare for the average Imperial citizen, and when it does happen, it's often the worst day of that citizen's life. If the Adeptus Astartes have been deployed to your world, it means war has come. The kind of apocalyptic war where human soldiers and simple defenses no longer suffice. The populace usually only sees space marines during planet-shattering crises. Hive cities overrun by Xeno's horrors, demonic incursions tearing reality, orc war bands rampaging across continents. In such hellish scenarios, salvation and destruction start to look frighteningly similar. Awe, fear, and transhuman dread. For those who do come face to face with a space marine, the experience is equal parts awe-inspiring and terrifying. Imagine looking up at a giant clad head to toe in thick battle plate, eyes glowing behind a skull-visaged helmet, a massive gun in his hands capable of exploding a person into red mist with one pull of the trigger. He moves with a purpose and speed no normal human could match, closing the gap in a blur despite his bulk. Everything about him is wrong by the laws of nature. A human shape made too large, too strong, too fast, and utterly unhesitating in violence. Imperial scholars actually have a term for the primal terror space marines instill in ordinary humans: transhuman dread. It is an instinctive, gut-churning fear triggered by seeing something human-shaped, but so far beyond human limits. Battle-hardened guardsmen have been struck dumb. Civilians have fainted or lost control of their bladders at the mere sight of Astartes charging into combat. The transhuman shock of witnessing an angel of death in motion can paralyze a person, a moment of horror where you realize this towering warrior could kill you without even noticing, and there's absolutely nothing you could do about it. Yet these same terrifying giants are on our side. They fight for the Emperor and the Imperium's people. That is the great paradox that every Imperial citizen must accept. The angels of death are meant to be our saviors. We are told from birth to trust in them. Propaganda broadcasts and ecclesiarchal sermons alike praise the noble deeds of the Adeptus Astartes. In stained glass windows of cathedrals, space marines are depicted as heroic knights defending the faithful. Official imperial texts recount countless worlds saved from annihilation by Astartes' intervention. All of it is true, and yet it's not the whole truth. The inspiring legends gloss over the collateral damage, the harsh pragmatism, and the cold distance that often define how space marines actually treat the humans they fight for. Myth and reality on the ground. When a space marine strike force lands in a war zone, their priorities are clear. Achieve the mission objective, destroy the enemy. Protecting civilians, while certainly a valued goal in theory, is usually a secondary concern at best. Unlike a human commander, a space marine has no family, no civilian friends, no personal stake in commerce or culture. His only family is his chapter, his only culture is war, and his stake is victory. This doesn't mean Astartes are wantonly cruel to innocent people. Most would never harm an Imperial civilian out of malice, but they will not hesitate to sacrifice lives if it serves the larger victory. They are brutally efficient and utterly unsentimental in this regard. After all, their entire upbringing has taught them a hard lesson. Individual lives are fleeting, but the Imperium must endure. A space marine thinks in terms of planets, centuries, and billions of souls. If a few thousand must die today so that billions live tomorrow, so be it. The Emperor protects, or rather, his angels selectively protect, when strategically feasible. To space marines, humanity is often an ideal or an abstraction. They fight for mankind's survival in the grand sense, not necessarily for Joe Habworker and his family cowering in a bunker. In fact, by the time the Marines arrive, Joe Habworker is probably already doomed. The situation is that dire. Many Astartes will carry on with the battle plan, allowing the civilian population's fate to fall under acceptable losses, as grim as that sounds. One veteran Imperial observer compared an Astartes on a mission to a player in a combat simulation game. The Space Marine isn't cruel to the little non-combatants in the scenario, but their well-being is essentially irrelevant compared to the objective. It's not personal, it's warfare in the 41st millennium. This detachment is only reinforced by how rarely Space Marines interact with normal people in everyday life. Most of the time, Marines are either on some distant battlefield where no civilians are present, deadly alien worlds, space hulks drifting in the void, demon-haunted war zones, or secluded in their chapter monasteries training for the next campaign. Within their fortresses and battle barges, they surround themselves with fellow post-humans or with indentured chapter serfs, menials and servants who keep the chapter running smoothly. These serfs are often the only regular humans a Marine sees routinely, and even then the relationship is one of master and servant, not peers. The serfs know to keep out of the way, to revere the Astartes lords and not burden them with trivial human problems. So when Marines deploy, they are not used to chatting with civilians or understanding civilian needs. Such concerns are completely outside their warrior existence. For the vast majority of Imperial citizens, a Space Marine is a distant symbol, not someone they'll ever meet. Many go their whole lives only seeing Astartes in picked holos or statues. And perhaps that's for the best. If you're seeing one in person, chances are you're in the middle of a war zone where death and destruction are raining down. To those few who survive a liberation or evacuation led by space marines, the Adeptus Astartes appear as stern, aloof saviors. They might bark orders at crowds of panicked refugees or wordlessly lift rubble off trapped survivors, and then just as swiftly move on to kill more enemies without a single comforting word. You won't get warm smiles or friendly pats on the back from an ultramarine in the field. At best, you might get a solemn nod of acknowledgement if you've fought bravely, or a curt command to stay out of the firing line. At worst, you might be ignored entirely as the giants march past you toward their next target, leaving you to find your own way to safety. Protectors and collateral damage. One harsh reality of the 41st millennium is that sometimes the only way to save a world is to destroy part of it. Space Marines understand this implicitly. They will not shy away from ordering an orbital bombardment on their own position, if it means wiping out an incoming Tyranid swarm, even if there are still innocent people caught in the bombardment zone. If exterminating a city today prevents a planet-wide genestealer cult uprising tomorrow, a Space Marine commander will give the order without flinching. The logic is brutal but straightforward. Better a million dead now than a billion later. To an Astartes, this isn't heartlessness, it's duty. In their minds, they're doing what must be done, the hard choices no one else can make. They carry the burden of those sacrifices so that humanity at large survives. Of course, to the people on the ground, it might feel like the Space Marines are as terrifying as the enemies they fight. There's a dark joke in some Imperial Guard regiments. When the Angels of Death arrive, first the aliens kill half of us, then the angels kill the rest by accident. It's not entirely fair. Marines do try to avoid unnecessary civilian casualties, but it contains a kernel of truth about how collateral damage seems almost inevitable when Astartes are unleashed. Buildings collapse in the wake of their heavy weapons, streets churn to rubble under the explosions, and anyone too slow or too close to the action can become a statistic. If a frantic mother and her children get caught in crossfire as Marines battle heretics in a shrine plaza, the Space Marines won't halt the firefight to rescue them. Mission first. Perhaps, if victory is secured, a Marine like a salamander might later pull survivors from the wreckage. But during the battle, the Astartes expects people to either save themselves or accept martyrdom. It's a harsh calculus, but that is the nature of war in the Imperium. As one Astartes captain famously said after a particularly bloody liberation of a city, "Regrettable, but we saved the planet." The Emperor judges success by the survival of humanity, not by the comfort of a few hundred thousand souls. Grimdark, indeed. Now, it would be a mistake to think all Space Marines treat civilians exactly the same. There is variation, born from each chapter's unique culture, history, and mentality. While no loyal Astartes chapter would ever intentionally harm innocent Imperial citizens without cause, some chapters genuinely go out of their way to shield and reassure civilians, whereas others pursue victory with near-total disregard for bystanders. In the next segment, we'll explore how different Space Marine chapters approach the burden of protecting mere mortals, from the compassionate zeal of the salamanders to the ruthless calculus of less forgiving brethren. Think of it as a spectrum of attitude. On one end, Marines who remember they were once human themselves and act accordingly. On the other, Marines for whom regular humans are little more than tools or obstacles in the war against chaos. Chapter by chapter. Different angels, different attitudes. The compassionate flame. salamanders. If any space marines can be called compassionate in this dark millennium, it is the salamanders. Hailing from the volcanic death world of Nocturne, the Salamanders chapter is renowned for its unusually close relationship with ordinary people. These sons of Vulcan believe, to their core, that one of their sacred duties is to protect the innocent. In battle, salamanders are known to divert from the plan to evacuate civilians or shield them from harm, something most other chapters would only do if it didn't jeopardize the mission. For salamanders, the people are the mission. This ethos stems from their Primarch Vulcan, who was a man of the people, a blacksmith who lived among Nocturne's tribesfolk, even after discovering his superhuman nature. His teachings emphasize tempering strength with mercy. As a result, salamander's recruits grow up in their chapter-keeping ties to their human kin. Uniquely, full-fledged Salamarine battle brothers often spend time living in Nocturne's towns during off-duty periods, integrating with their communities. They don't rule as tyrants or aloof warrior nobility. They live as guardians and neighbors, albeit giant, gene-enhanced neighbors. This constant reminder of their origins keeps salamanders empathetic toward the common folk in a way that many other Astartes simply can't fathom. On the battlefield, the salamander's compassion shines through even the grim necessity of war. There are numerous accounts of salamander squads forming a cordon to ferry civilians out of a kill zone, carrying wounded civilians on their shoulders to safety while rounds bounce off their armor. They prioritize minimizing collateral damage. They'll favor precise melta strikes over indiscriminate shelling if civilians are nearby, even if it means putting themselves in greater danger. One famous and somewhat legendary anecdote tells of a salamander's captain halting his advance because a child had been separated from her parents in the panic. He personally reunited the family before pressing on against the enemy. Whether or not that exact tale is embellished, it exemplifies the chapter's reputation. To a salamander, every life saved is a victory for the Emperor. This compassionate stance famously brought the salamanders into conflict with another far more callous chapter during the Third War for Armageddon. On that beleaguered world, civilian refugees from a destroyed hive city had huddled in a camp called Emperor's Deliverance, hoping for evacuation from the green-skinned orcs ravaging the planet. The salamanders, of course, took great pains to defend the refugee camp, interposing themselves between the vulnerable civilians and rampaging orcs whenever possible. But another chapter present was the Marines Malevolent, who had a very different philosophy. The Marines Malevolent believed that no price was too high to destroy the Emperor's foes, even if that price was paid in innocent lives. When a massive orc warband threatened to overrun the camp entirely, the Marines Malevolent commander, Captain Vinyar, made a chilling decision. He held back his forces, deliberately allowing the orcs to crash into the refugee camp. Only once the greenskins were in among the tents, slaughtering defenseless families, did he order an artillery barrage on the area. Whirlwind missiles rained down, obliterating orcs, and thousands of refugees all the same. In Captain Vinyar's eyes, it was a necessary sacrifice to wipe out the Xenos. To the salamanders who arrived on the scene, it was nothing short of monstrous. In the aftermath, Salamander's chapter master Tushan confronted Captain Vinyar amidst the smoking ruin of the camp. The air was thick with ash and the stench of death. Shredded bodies of the very people the Marines were supposed to protect lying everywhere. Witnesses describe a tense standoff. Tushan's anger was as hot as Nocturnian fire as he accused Vinyar of callous slaughter. Vinyar, unrepentant, spat back that the end justifies the means in war. Words turned to blows. Legend has it that Tushan actually seized the Marine's malevolent captain by the throat, or even struck him, a scandalous breach of Astartes protocol. The two chapters nearly came to outright battle with each other. Ultimately, the Marines Malevolent were censured by the Inquisition for their actions, and their name earned lasting infamy. Meanwhile, the Salamanders doubled down on rescue efforts, doing all they could to help the remaining survivors of Armageddon. That incident is often cited in Imperial records as a rare case of Astartes coming to blows over the treatment of civilians. It perfectly illustrates the Salamanders' stance. To them, sacrificing innocence is an absolute last resort, if a resort at all, and they'll even defy fellow space marines who cross that line. Of course, even salamanders have limits. This is still the grimdark future. They can't save everyone. There are times they, too, have had to harden their hearts. But it speaks volumes that among the Adeptus Astartes, the Salamanders are considered nearly soft by their peers because of their humanitarian streak. Other chapters sometimes tease that the Salamanders babysit mortals too much or risk objectives by coddling civilians. The Salamanders wear such criticism as a badge of honor. In a galaxy of endless war, showing compassion is a radical act. And so, when the average citizen prays for deliverance, many specifically pray that it's the emerald-armored salamanders who answer the call, for they know those warriors will treat them as human beings worth saving. Wolves among sheep space wolves. The space wolves, those ferocious heroes of Fenris, have a reputation as one of the more unorthodox and human-friendly chapters, albeit in a very space Viking sort of way. Hailing from the frozen death world of Fenris and led by their legendary Primarch, Leman Russ, the Space Wolves see themselves as the protectors of humanity's pack. They are warriors with a barbarian sense of honor and loyalty. If the Salamanders are compassionate guardians, the Space Wolves are the fierce older brothers of the Imperium, rowdy, blunt, and ready to bloody anyone who threatens their kin. To be clear, the Space Wolves aren't exactly going around hugging civilians or handing out candy to kids. They are feral in aspect and terrifying in battle, fanged, sometimes literally howling, slayers with a penchant for melee combat. But they do genuinely care for the people of the Imperium, especially the downtrodden or those they consider under their protection. There's a strong streak of nobility under that wolf's pelt exterior. On Fenris, the Space Wolves still recruit from the hardy tribes of humans who survived that world's brutal conditions. Those tribes revere the Sky Warriors, as they call the wolves, as living demigods, yes. But there's also an understanding that the wolves are their demigods. A space wolf remembers life as a tribesman. He remembers the bonds of family and the duty of a chieftain to his people. This mentality carries over when they fight across the galaxy. The wolves often bristle at what they perceive as the callousness or tyranny of the Imperium's authorities toward common folk. On more than one occasion, space wolves have stepped in to defend civilian populations, not just from aliens, but from other Imperial forces who threaten them unjustly. The most famous example of this is the Months of Shame incident following the First War for Armageddon. After that war, in which the Space Wolves and Grey Knights defeated the demon Primarch Angron, the Inquisition decided that every surviving Imperial guardsman and civilian who had witnessed the demonic invasion had to be purged or permanently silenced to prevent knowledge of chaos from spreading. This Armageddon containment policy was incredibly draconian. We're talking about sterilizing millions of civilians and sending them to labor camps, even executing entire regiments of brave guardsmen who had just risked their lives to save the planet. The Inquisition's stance was, better kill a million loyal souls than risk one heretic escaping. Most Imperial institutions would grimly nod and carry out orders. Not the Space Wolves. Logan Grimnar, the Great Wolf, chapter master of the Space Wolves, was outraged at this betrayal of the very people they'd fought to protect. He famously snarled that there was no point saving a world's population from demons, only to murder or enslave that population afterward. When Inquisitors and their enforcer teams came to round up Armageddon's survivors, the Space Wolves outright defied them. Grimnar's wolves blocked Inquisitorial troops from entering refugee camps, escorted hundreds of civilians to safety, and even smuggled entire shiploads of veterans and civilians off Armageddon to spare them from the Inquisition's purge. In effect, the Space Wolves went to war with the Inquisition and their allies to defend those innocents. This spiraled into a series of tense confrontations known as the Months of Shame. There were actual space battles between Space Wolves vessels and Inquisitorial Navy ships. In one stark incident, a transport ship carrying 400,000 Armageddon refugees, protected by a Space Wolves frigate, was fired upon and destroyed by a Grey Knight's strike cruiser on the Inquisition's orders, slaughtering all aboard just to enforce the quarantine. The wolves were livid, but held their fury long enough to gather reinforcements. Grimnar then deployed his fleet in a protective cordon around multiple refugee transports, daring the Inquisition to continue the slaughter. With the arrival of the massive Space Wolves battle barge, Gilfarheim tipping the naval balance, the Inquisitors had to back down and let many transports escape. The Space Wolves had saved tens of thousands from Imperial retribution, though tragically, the Inquisition subsequently hunted those escapees across the galaxy, even virus-bombing worlds they fled to, a grim reminder that no good deed goes unpunished in the Imperium. In the end, a stalemate of sorts was reached, with neither side wanting to push into full fratricidal war. But the message was sent loud and clear. The Space Wolves will not stand by while innocent citizens or honorable guardsmen are butchered under some bureaucrat's orders. They shed blood to defend the Emperor's people, not just from the Xeno, but from Imperial justice gone wrong. This rebellious compassion defines the Space Wolves' attitude. They have a healthy disrespect for authority and dogma, especially when those get in the way of basic decency or their warrior code. In more everyday terms, Space Wolves are known to actually interact with civilians in a rough but friendly manner on campaign. After a victory, a wolf lord might host a grand feast with Imperial Guard officers and any local militia leaders, downing ale by the barrel and swapping stories with mortal soldiers, something some ultra-strict Codex adherent chapters like the Iron Hands would never do. There are tales of Space Wolves sharing drinks with villagers they've saved, or giving a booming laugh and a clap on the back to an awestruck PDF trooper who showed courage. To the Space Wolves, valor is valor, whether it comes from a demigod, Astartes, or a frail human. They respect fighting spirit. They'll affectionately call a brave human soldier little brother or sister in arms. And there is real warmth in that, even if, to an outsider, the wolf's huge fanged grin might still look scary. Of course, if you're a cowardly bureaucrat, or, Emperor forbid, an inquisitor threatening their flock, a Space Wolf's demeanor turns icy cold. Then you'll see the famed Fenrisian snarl, and it's like a giant dire wolf ready to tear out someone's throat. In short, the Space Wolves treat civilians and humble soldiers with a kind of fierce protective instinct. They aren't gentle. They might honestly scare the living daylights out of a hive city clerk just by proximity and their loud, boisterous ways. But their intentions toward the common folk are usually honorable. They truly see themselves as the guardians of mankind's common man, the watchful wolves that keep the monsters at bay. Just don't expect polished manners or mercy for the enemy. A Space Wolf will cheerfully incinerate an orc or chaos cultist and decorate his armor with the skull, all while reassuring a frightened child that no monster will hurt you now, by Russ. I swear it. It's a mix of savagery and kindness that perhaps only the Space Wolves could pull off credibly. the Noble Lord's Ultramarines. On the surface, the Ultramarines and their many successor chapters, often called Codex-compliant chapters, seem to embody the image of the shining knightly space marine that Imperial citizens idealize. Hailing from the realm of Ultramar, a collection of prosperous human worlds they govern, the Ultramarines project an aura of civilization, honor, and duty. Under their Primarch, Robute Guillemon's legacy, they are not just warriors, but statesmen and empire builders. So, how do these aristocratic super soldiers treat ordinary humans? Largely with a firm but fair hand, a sort of paternalistic responsibility. If the Space Wolves are rowdy elder brothers, the Ultramarines are the stern, dutiful father figures of the Imperium. They genuinely believe in protecting the people, but they will do it in the most efficient and orderly way possible, feelings be damned. In Ultramar, the sub-empire of 500 worlds under ultramarine protection, the citizens actually enjoy a relatively high standard of life. Again, relatively. This is still a far future feudal theocracy by modern measure. The reason is that the ultramarines take governance seriously. Every ultramarines officer is trained in the principles of Guillemon's Codex Astartes, which, aside from tactics, also imparts ideals of leadership and stewardship. They see the population as the foundation of the Imperium. Protecting and cultivating that foundation is part of the grand strategy. There are many tales in the lore of ultramarine captains stepping in to rebuild infrastructure, organize PDF defenses, and render honors to local heroes after a conflict. For example, after driving off an alien attack, an ultramarines force might stay to help distribute rations and medical aid in a city of their realm before moving on. Tasks some more war-obsessed chapters would consider not our problem. In the Ultramarines' view, stability and morale on the home front are key to long-term victory. It's almost Roman in its ethos, fitting since Guillemon intentionally modeled Ultramar on the Roman ideal of enlightened governance. Citizens of Ultramar tend to adore the Astartes as warrior knights who keep them safe and uphold justice. The chapter's presence is woven into their society's fabric, monuments in town squares, public ceremonies where the Space Marines appear to renew oaths of protection, etc. So there is a real sense of mutual loyalty, at least within Ultramar itself. When Ultramarines, or similar-minded chapters like the Imperial Fists or Crimson Fists, etc., are fighting elsewhere in the galaxy, they try to adhere to those high standards as much as war allows. They are generally disciplined about minimizing civilian casualties and follow the Imperial rules of war. An Ultramarines commander will attempt negotiations to evacuate civilians before, say, bombarding a city full of cultists, if time permits. They'll coordinate with the planetary governor or local defense leaders, treating them with formal respect. As long as those leaders aren't incompetent, Guillemon's boys have little patience for incompetence. When fighting alongside the Imperial Guard, Ultramarines often strive to be shining examples, encouraging the human troops fighting at the forefront to inspire them. Many Guard officers who've served with Ultramarines mention their professional courtesy and how reassuring it is to have these stalwart giants on their side. One well-known example from the novel Nightbringer: Captain Uriel Ventress of the Ultramarines risked his life repeatedly to save a planetary population from Necron raiders, even dueling an ancient Necron lord in the process. He was willing to pay the ultimate price to protect the people. That's the kind of heroism Ultramarines aspire to. They'd rather die gloriously than live with failure to defend humanity. That said, Ultramarines can also come off as cold and utilitarian when push comes to shove. If sacrificing one city will save 10 others, an Ultramarine will give the order without letting emotion sway him. They won't relish it, but they'll do it and tell themselves it was the logical choice. Guillemon was ever the pragmatist. Unlike salamanders who might agonize over such a decision, ultramarines compartmentalize and carry on. Some critics, especially more brutal chapters, consider them a bit too idealistic or restrained, while some more free-spirited types, like space wolves, find them stuffy. And indeed, the ultramarine's noble bearing can shade into a kind of benevolent arrogance. They see themselves as the exemplars of what a space marine should be, and by extension, they naturally assume a leadership role over any situation. A proud planetary noble might bristle at how an ultramarine captain politely takes over command of a war zone, effectively treating the planet's defense forces as subordinates. But to the ultramarine, that's just duty. He has the greater experience and strength, so of course he should lead for everyone's good. Usually, though, people are glad to follow if it means victory. One area where ultramarines shine is their respect for the Imperial Guard and militia forces. They often go out of their way to acknowledge the contributions of human soldiers. After a battle, an ultramarine commander might publicly praise a guard regiment's sacrifice or personally thank a colonel for his unit's efforts. This does wonders for morale. Imagine a grizzled guardsman who's lost half his friends in a fight, being approached by a towering ultramarine who removes his helmet, meets the soldier's eyes, and says, "Well fought, brother. The Emperor himself honors your courage." That kind of moment becomes legend in the regiment. It costs the ultramarine nothing to show that respect, and it reinforces the proper order of things. Space marines fight for humanity, not in spite of it. Guillemon himself famously said that without the billions of ordinary people producing, fighting, and supporting the war effort, even the Astartes would falter. So ultramarines keep that perspective. In summary, ultramarines treat civilians as valued subjects under their protection, but expect those civilians to do their duty and follow orders in return. They can be kind, but never lenient. Everyone has their role to play in Guillemon's grand vision of the Imperium. If you are a loyal and diligent citizen, an ultramarine will shelter you, die for you if needed. If you panic or rebel or falter, they won't hesitate to enforce discipline or make an example of failure. It's very much a tough love approach. The good news is, if you're living under an ultramarine's banner world, you're probably safer and better off than billions of other Imperials. Just don't expect them to crack a joke to put you at ease or to let you skip curfew during a Xenos invasion because you left your Grox herd outside the walls. Orders are orders for humans and space marines alike. Zealous Crusaders, Black Templars. Now we turn to the Black Templars, a chapter whose attitude toward civilians can be summed up in one word. Zealotry. The Black Templars are the quintessential fanatical knights of the Emperor, forever on a crusade to smite the heretic, witch, and Xenos, wherever they can be found. They have no single homeworld. Instead, they roam the stars in massive crusade fleets, accompanied often by hordes of zealous devotees, clerics, and attendants. These space marines are driven by faith and war alone. So where do ordinary people figure in their worldview? In short, as followers to be guided and protected spiritually, but hardly coddled physically. The Templars revere the Emperor as a god and see themselves as his chosen holy warriors. To them, civilians are the Emperor's flock, worth defending from external threats, certainly, but expected to endure hardships and show faith without complaint. If they die, they die martyrs. If they live, it's only because the Emperor, through the Templars' bolters and blades, willed it. Black Templars have a bit of a reputation in the Imperium for being aloof and harsh toward those they protect. They're not cruel oppressors. They truly believe they are righteous and just. But empathy is not their strong suit. Picture a fortress city under siege by chaos cultists. The civilians inside are terrified. A squad of Black Templars arrives, leading a relief force. The people cheer, expecting comforting words from these warrior monks. Instead, the Templar Castellan might thunder a sermon about purity and sacrifice, chastising any who had wavered in their faith during the crisis. He may impose strict curfews and mandate daily prayers, executing a few suspected heretics on the spot to set an example. For the greater good of their souls and the morale of the defense, of course. Then the Templars will lead a valiant charge to break the siege, undoubtedly saving the city, but perhaps at the cost of heavy civilian casualties in the crossfire, casualties they will dismiss as the Emperor's will. After victory, there is no tender rebuilding or compassion. The Black Templars pack up and march off to find the next battle, leaving the shocked survivors to pick up the pieces, presumably stronger in faith after their ordeal. That's the Black Templar way. One reason for this stern approach is that Black Templars idolize their spiritual predecessor, the Imperial Fist's Primarch Rogel Dorn, and the Great Crusade mentality. They aspire to the days when space marines were true crusading knights, conquering and converting entire systems. In that ethos, the mission is everything. Civilians are expected to do their part by praying, obeying, and not getting in the way of the swords. There's an infamous bit of rivalry between Black Templars and Salamanders that illustrates their difference. During the Third War for Armageddon, the Salamanders criticized the Black Templars for being so focused on slaying the enemy that they did little to help evacuate civilians or coordinate refugee relief. The Black Templars, in turn, sneered that the Salamanders wasted precious time babysitting mortals instead of properly engaging the Orc warlord head-on. It wasn't that the Templars wanted innocents to die. They just believed the best defense for those people was a swift offense against the orcs. And if that meant civilians caught in the crossfire, that was regrettable but acceptable. Faith in the Emperor's plan leaves little room for second-guessing or sentiment. Another aspect is that Black Templars, by doctrine, are extremely intolerant of any impurity. A civilian population that shows cowardice, impiety, or, worst of all, sympathy to witches or aliens might just find the Black Templars turning their bolters on them next. Templars don't really do the whole win hearts and minds thing gently. They'd rather scare people straight. It's noted in some records that Black Templar chaplains accompanying Imperial forces have enforced brutal discipline and flagellant rites on local PDFs to steel them for battle. They see it as toughening the weak for the trials to come. Many ordinary soldiers under their care might privately grumble that the Templars treat them barely better than they treat the enemy. But again, in the Templars' perspective, this life is fleeting. Only service to the Emperor matters. If a few hundred guardsmen are flogged raw, or a scared villager is shot for blaspheming in panic, those are righteous corrections to ensure collective spiritual fortitude. Mercy is a luxury the Black Templars believe humanity can't afford in the face of sin and danger. Yet, paradoxically, the Black Templars are also revered by masses of the faithful. Why? Because they embody the uncompromising wrath of the Emperor. To a devout hive world zealot, a Black Templar is a savior who will smite the mutant and heretic without hesitation. Many civilians may fear them, but also willingly follow their commands, seeing them as warrior priests. There are thousands of lay pilgrims and fanatics who attach themselves to Black Templar crusades, collectively called the Templars' Crusade Fleets. These attendants form something like a moving city of devotees that travel with the chapter's ships. The Templars tolerate these civilian hangers-on as long as they are useful, tending to supplies, chanting litanies, being serfs. In a sense, they do care for those people, but in a shepherd-guiding-sheep manner. the sheep must stay in line, or the shepherd's crook will crack down. In summary, if you're an upstanding, pious imperial citizen, a Black Templar will protect you from the alien scourge fiercely. But he'll expect you to endure hellish conditions without complaint, and praise the Emperor for the privilege. If you falter or question, you might find that same protection withdrawn or turned into purgation. They are the epitome of grimdark knights, pure in intent, harsh in action, giving no quarter to either the foe or the weakling among their charges. Civilians under Black Templar protection often survive the war miraculously, only to realize the cost was their innocence and perhaps a good deal of blood. The cursed and the dutiful Blood Angels and successors. The Blood Angels present a study in contrast when it comes to their dealings with mortals. On one hand, they are among the most noble and cultured of chapters. They descend from the angelic Primarch, Sanguinius, a figure so beloved by the common folk that a galaxy-wide holiday, Sanguinala, honors his sacrifice. Blood Angels are known for their artistry, their refined manners, and a certain tragic empathy. They strive to exemplify Sanguinius's virtues of protecting humanity, inspiring hope even in dark times. Many civilians see the golden-armored Blood Angels as literal saviors, angelic in appearance and deed, especially when they first arrive. A Blood Angel might speak kindly to a frightened pilgrim, or ensure an evacuation transport takes off safely before he wades back into battle. They often carry an aura of sorrowful compassion. They want humanity to thrive and be happy, in a way some more stern chapters might not think about. Indeed, Blood Angels and their successor chapters have been known to undertake heroic self-sacrifices to defend populations. During the Second War for Armageddon, Commander Dante of the Blood Angels famously coordinated with the other chapters to save the Hive Cities from Orc hordes, and his Blood Angels threw themselves into the fiercest fighting to minimize the bloodshed of civilians huddling behind the gates. In those moments, they were every bit the heroic angels their imagery suggests. However, and it's a big however, the Blood Angels carry a terrible curse in their gene seed, the Red Thirst and the Black Rage. These flaws mean that every Blood Angel is haunted by a craving for blood, and at times, visions of madness relating to their Primarch's death. Most control it through discipline and ritual, but sometimes it overcomes them, turning them into frenzied berserkers who can't distinguish friend from foe. This is exceedingly rare, but the mere possibility influences how the Blood Angels handle civilians, with a mix of protectiveness and distance. They are very careful not to lose control near innocents. You'll seldom see a Blood Angel remove his helmet in front of a crowd of refugees. Better to keep that literal and figurative visor down, protecting others from glimpsing the hunger in his eyes. They often speak little in such situations, afraid that too much stimulation could ignite the thirst. If a battle has been particularly fierce and the scent of blood heavy in the air, the Blood Angels will isolate themselves rather than mingle with human allies for everyone's safety. There's a poignant story from the Horus Heresy era, but illustrative, where a Blood Angel, freshly traumatized, is approached by a human boy asking for help. And for a split second, the Marine's vision wavers with bloodlust. He catches himself, horrified, and hastily steps away, leaving the confused child behind. He later ensures the boy was safe, but he dared not interact in the moment. That encapsulates the tragic edge. The Blood Angels care deeply, but they fear they might inadvertently hurt those they care for if the curse strikes. Blood Angels' successors, like the Flesh Tearers, have even more troubled interactions. The Flesh Tearers specifically have a dark reputation for civilian casualties. This chapter, descended from Sanguinius as well, struggles immensely with the Red Thirst. they've been involved in several grim incidents where, after or even during a battle, flesh-tearer Marines succumbed to their blood fury and massacred innocents alongside enemies. One notorious example is the Callern Massacres. During a campaign in the 36th millennium, flesh-tearers in the heat of combat fell to the Black Rage and slaughtered hundreds of civilians they were supposed to be defending, not just the foe. That atrocity nearly got the chapter declared heretical and destroyed. Only political maneuvering and the intervention of other Blood Angels chapters spared them. Since then, even allied Imperial forces are very wary around flesh-tearers. It's a grim, whispered understanding. If the flesh-tearers deploy to save your city, pray the battle ends quickly and that they depart before their darker impulses break loose. Their chapter master, Gabriel Seth, is a pragmatic, brooding figure who openly admits that if they cannot control the curse, one day the flesh-tearers will essentially doom themselves. In the meantime, though, Seth leads them to fight for the Imperium with ferocity unmatched, hoping their noble deeds outweigh the horror of their lapses. He has, in fact, ordered his men off of battlefields sooner rather than later once victory is assured, precisely to avoid an unfortunate incident with survivors. It's an eerie sight. The flesh-tearers storm a city to liberate it from chaos cultists, achieve victory drenched in blood, and then depart at once without a word, leaving the dumbstruck citizens wondering why their saviors were in such a hurry. Little do they know it's because those saviors are moments away from seeing them as the next course in a sanguinary frenzy. The core Blood Angels chapter is far more controlled than their edgier successors. They put enormous effort into behaving as exemplars and keep their bloodlust in check through rituals, art, and brotherhood. As a result, a Blood Angels company aiding an evacuation will likely be extremely courteous, yet somewhat distant. They've been known to show small kindnesses, a Blood Angel apothecary treating wounded civilians when time allows, or a sergeant giving a fallen guardsman a proper burial out of respect. These acts come from genuine empathy, but always lurking is the knowledge that they must keep their interaction measured. The moment a battle turns, the Blood Angels throw themselves into violence with a ferocity that can be frightening even to onlookers on the same side. It's like seeing a polished knight suddenly morph into a raging beast on the battlefield, thrilling when aimed at the enemy, but you pray that beast never turns its red gaze toward you. In summary, the Blood Angels aspire to treat civilians like the precious charges Sanguinius died to protect. In their ideal vision, a Blood Angel is a noble guardian who defends humanity's future and maybe even takes time to appreciate the art and culture that humanity creates. Many do live up to that ideal when they can. But the reality of their curse means there's always a slight gap between them and the people. A bit of glass separating the angel from the crowd, for everyone's good. And the closer one gets to the successor chapters like the flesh-tearers, that glass becomes a wall of adamantium. For behind it lies a potential killer straining at the leash. The duality of the Blood Angels is one of the most tragic in the Astartes. They love humanity's light, yet within them lies humanity's darkest hunger. The secretive and the soulless dark angels and iron hands. Not all differences come from noble ideals or curses. Some are cultural quirks that make certain space marines particularly distant or dismissive toward humans. Two examples on nearly opposite ends of temperament are the Dark Angels and the Iron Hands. The Dark Angels, first of the legions, are enigmatic and brooding knights who carry heavy secrets. They were the very first Space Marine Legion created, with a glory and a shame that only they know fully. Interaction with regular humans for them is always tinged by their paranoia and obsession with atoning for an ancient sin. The Fallen, though few outside the chapter know about that. As such, Dark Angels are polite but extremely remote around others, including fellow Imperial forces. To civilians, a Dark Angel might appear as a silent hooded savior, one moment appearing out of nowhere to gun down a marauding chaos brute, then disappearing without even staying for thanks. They tend to avoid casual contact or conversation. Partly it's monastic discipline. Partly it's that they simply don't trust anyone who isn't one of their own circle. They fear that anyone could be a potential informant or witness to their secret hunts for the fallen, renegade Dark Angels from millennia past. So if a civilian happens to see something they shouldn't, say, a group of Dark Angels capturing one of these mysterious fallen traitors, that poor soul is unlikely to remain free or alive long. The Dark Angels will calmly and coolly detain or eliminate any witnesses to their clandestine missions, no matter if those witnesses are loyal Imperial citizens. This ruthless policy has led to dark rumors about the Dark Angels among those few in the know, whispers that they care more about their own agenda than the lives of the people. There's truth to that. While they certainly fight valiantly against alien invasions or heretic uprisings, and civilians on those battlefields are grateful for their protection, the moment the chapter's secret quest intersects with human lives, those lives become very expendable. The Dark Angels see it as containing potential heresy. One proverb in their ranks says, "Loose lips deliver damnation." Thus, if a PDF trooper glimpses a fallen prisoner or hears a suspicious exchange, the Dark Angel's robed interrogator chaplain may quietly execute him rather than risk word getting out. It's chilling, but the Dark Angels rationalize it as saving many more in the long run. The Imperium at large must never know the Dark Angel's shameful secret, or it could spark distrust and conflict, at least so they believe. For civilians who just experience a straightforward Dark Angels military intervention, their impression is likely. These Space Marines were stoic and grim, but they saved us. The Dark Angels often deploy rapidly, strike precisely, and maintain strict discipline. A villager might say, "They appeared from the shadows, fought like wrathful angels, and then vanished." Little do they realize that had that villager gotten too curious or followed the Dark Angels after the battle, he might have been quietly disappeared as well. In essence, Dark Angels treat civilians with cold, arm's-length courtesy and as potential liabilities to be managed if necessary. They're not cruel for cruelty's sake. They just have zero tolerance for anything that might imperil their chapter's reputation or mission. Better 100 innocents die than a single hint of the fallen reach inquisitive ears. It's a very secret police mentality wrapped in knightly trappings. Many Dark Angel successors, like the Angels of Absolution, etc., share this trait to varying degrees. So, while they aren't known for outright harming populations, there's always a bit of a sinister aura that puts people on edge around them. It's like they're guarding you, but also judging you silently, and you're never sure if you're found worthy or wanting until they leave, or until it's too late for you. On the other hand, the Iron Hands chapter illustrates a different form of detachment. These Marines are cold, machine-worshipping warriors who believe in the credo, "The flesh is weak." They despise weakness, including the frailties of the human body and emotion. As a result, the Iron Hands and their successors tend to view normal humans as pathetically fragile and inferior. They don't really bother with niceties or inspiration. Their interactions are often terse commands or brutal assessments. An Iron Hands Tech Marine might stroll through a refugee column not to comfort them, but to evaluate how many are too wounded to survive, or how they can be put to efficient labor. In some cases, Iron Hands have been known to put out of their misery those they deem too far gone. It's almost a mercy in their eyes. Better a quick death than living as a limbless cripple or a shell-shocked wretch. There's that chilling account from a campaign, noted in a Black Library novel, where a company of Iron Hands were stranded with a regiment of elite human soldiers after a crash. Realizing the humans could not keep up with the grueling pace required to reach safety and would only slow the Astartes down, the Iron Hands commander made a ruthless decision. He executed the wounded and ordered the rest of the humans to remain and defend a position to the last man as a distraction, while the Iron Hands moved on to complete the mission. To the Iron Hands, this wasn't betrayal or malice. It was pure logic. The humans would have died anyway in the wastes, so at least their deaths served a purpose to buy time. This demonstrates how an Iron Hands space marine weighs human life, purely in terms of utility and strength. If you're strong, useful, and efficient, they'll tolerate you. Perhaps even upgrade you with a bionic limb out of a twisted sense of charity. If you're weak or inefficient, expect no sympathy and possibly a bolt round to end your weakness. Civilians encountering Iron Hands likely find them utterly frightening. These Marines replace much of their own flesh with cybernetics, so they can appear more machine than man, with glowing red bionic eyes and clanking servo limbs. They speak in a distorted, emotionless tone. If a crying child clings to an Iron Hand's leg begging for help, the Iron Hand might simply stare, state obstacle detected, and pry the child off, or walk away, leaving the child confused. Their concern is defeating the enemy and then moving on. They leave humanitarian follow-up to the Administratum or Mechanicus. In one incident on the Forge world of Contqual, the Iron Hands purged a Chaos Rebellion by basically leveling entire districts and any civilians in them without hesitation. In their view, the civilians were already spiritually corrupted by exposure, or at least compromised by weakness. So better to eradicate the whole area and let the Emperor sort them out. The few survivors described the Iron Hands as iron statues that killed everything moving. The chapter did eventually help rebuild the forges. They like machinery, after all. But the people? Those were replaceable. In their fortress monastery, Iron Hands keep human thralls and tech adepts around, but treat them as part of the machinery resources to be ordered, not individuals to converse with. There's no malice. It's almost a clinical dehumanization. Humans are frail units in the grand calculus of war, nothing more. That said, ironically, the Iron Hands' brutal approach can protect lives in a roundabout way, by ending wars faster through overwhelming force. If wiping out a whole contaminated hive will stop a demonic incursion, the Iron Hands will do it in a heartbeat, perhaps preventing a longer war that would have consumed more lives. They see that as a net win, though try explaining that to those who are on the wrong end of their guns. To an Iron Hand, emotion or empathy are flaws that cloud judgment. In their eyes, the Emperor forged them to be weapons, not caretakers. So they prosecute war with merciless efficiency, and if you survive under their protection, consider yourself lucky that you met their standard of acceptable losses. No witnesses, no mercy. The extreme cases. Up to now, we've mostly discussed mainstream loyalist chapters, but it's worth noting a few extreme cases in the Adeptus Astartes, where the treatment of civilians, and even allies, crosses into outright nightmarish territory. These are exceptions, but they do exist and remind us that loyal space marines can still be utterly terrifying for ordinary humans. One such case, the Grey Knights. Though technically part of the Inquisition's Ordo Malleus, rather than a normal chapter, Grey Knights are Space Marines' elite, secret demon-hunting Space Marines. Their policy towards civilians can be summed up as, what civilians? There were no civilians here. Why? Because the Grey Knights operate in absolute secrecy. If they intervene to stop a chaos demon incursion on a world, Every single witness who saw the demonic, or, heaven forbid, saw the Grey Knights themselves, is potentially a security breach. In many documented instances, after saving a population from a chaos assault, the Grey Knights and Inquisition have carried out a total purge or mind wipe of those very people they saved. The rationale: knowledge of chaos is a contagion that must not spread, and the existence of the Grey Knights, the Emperor's demon-killing angels, must remain legend. Famously, at the close of the First War for Armageddon, the same event where Space Wolves rebelled, the Grey Knights aided in banishing the bloodthirster Angron. Then, with cold efficiency, they helped oversee the rounding up of the planet's entire surviving population for deportation to labor camps, and the mass execution of many Guard veterans who had fought beside them. The people hailed the Grey Knights as heroes one day. The next day, Inquisitorial stormtroopers were injecting them with sedatives and dragging them off to sterilization camps. Any who resisted or asked too many questions were summarily shot. The Grey Knights stood by and let it happen, even enforced it when needed. Because to them, protecting humanity often means protecting it from tainted knowledge, at any price. There's an even starker anecdote from a later conflict. During the purification of a chaos-corrupted city, a squad of Grey Knights found that a convent of the Sisters of Battle, who are devout Imperial allies, had been massacred by a powerful demon. The surviving sisters were few, but they were contaminated by the demon's foul blood. The Grey Knights, in order to sanctify themselves and defeat that demon, did something shocking. They killed the remaining innocent sisters and bathed in their blood as a purifying ritual, using the faith-infused blood of those martyrs as a weapon against the demon. It worked. The demon was banished. But to any outside observer, this would look like the Grey Knights slaughtered their allies in cold blood. In their logic, it was the only way, an exchange of a few lives to save millions. This story underscores how utterly uncompromising the Grey Knights are regarding collateral damage. Civilians who see chaos are often considered as good as dead already. A Grey Knight would incinerate a building full of scared villagers without a second thought if even one cultist was hiding among them. And afterwards, he'd erase any memory that he was ever there. For the common Imperial citizen, the Grey Knights are unknown figures, and that's intentional. If you ever meet one, chances are you won't remember it, or you won't be around to talk about it. In a sense, the Grey Knights treat civilians by making sure there are no civilians left to treat in a chaos-tainted war zone. It's arguably for the greater good of humanity's soul, but try telling that to those sacrificed on the altar of secrecy. Another extreme example on the opposite end of the loyalty spectrum are chapters like The Marines Malevolent or The Carcharodons, Space Sharks. We already saw the Marines Malevolent's callous shelling of refugees on Armageddon. That chapter's general ethos is consistently ruthless. They have been known to commit borderline war crimes and have faced censure for it. Allies hate fighting alongside them because they blatantly disregard friendly casualties. Their attitude to civilians is collateral damage, unfortunate, but who cares? They don't win many friends, and indeed many other Space Marines consider them a disgrace. But the chapter still exists, fighting the Emperor's wars in their bloody-minded way, presumably because results matter more than methods in some High Lord's calculation. If the Marines Malevolent turn the tide of battle by doing something horrific yet effective, the Imperium tends to look the other way, or not look at all. The Carcharodons, a fleet-based chapter from the outer darkness of space, take a similarly frightening approach. Descended possibly from the Raven Guard, but far removed culturally, these space sharks are infamous for extreme brutality. During the Badab War, a conflict of Astartes versus Astartes, The Carcharodons defeated a rebel faction and then imposed such draconian punishment on the conquered worlds that it horrified other loyalists. They depopulated entire cities, recruiting the strongest survivors into their chapter and forcing others into deadly trials. One story recounts how, on a defeated planet, the Carcharodons gathered all male civilians of a fighting age and made them fight each other to the death. Only the last few standing were spared, likely taken as chapter serfs or even potential neophytes, while all others lay in blood. This was not because those people were traitors. It was simply the Carcharodon way of ensuring only the fiercest, fittest remained to serve the Imperium, and also perhaps a method of terror to prevent future rebellion. They also executed planetary officials en masse and scoured the resources for their fleet. Basically, they operate on a primal survival of the fittest law. To them, civilized concepts of protecting the weak may seem laughable. The Carcharodons view themselves as predators unleashed by the Imperium to do what others won't. If that means entire populations are expended in the process, so be it. They often leave ghost worlds in their wake, enemies slain, and the remaining populace either evacuated, eaten, there are cannibalism rumors, or too traumatized to recover soon. It's worth stressing these are loyal Astartes by classification. They are not chaos marauders. Yet, to an average person, the difference might be academic. When gray-armored giants with shark teeth insignia show up, you might actually prefer the quick death by the invaders, rather than the salvation of these lunatics. Fortunately, chapters like this are rare and usually deployed far from densely populated sectors. They're the boogeymen of the Adeptus Astartes. Finally, even within generally honorable chapters, there can be individuals or sub-factions that exhibit chilling behavior. The notorious flesh-tearers we covered, but even a chapter like the Minotaurs. An aggressive chapter, often doing dirty work for the High Lords, has a rep for slaughtering anyone who stands in their way, friend or foe. They once assaulted a space station held by another Imperial chapter, and collateral damage to station crew and servitors was immense, simply because the Minotaurs had zero patience for negotiation. These types treat normal humans as literal cannon fodder or obstacles. It's a reminder that Astartes are not uniform in temperament. Some are fundamentally decent, if strict, guardians, and some are barely restrained sociopaths who happen to be aimed at the enemy. Conclusion. So, how do space marines treat civilians? The uncomfortable answer is, as harshly as the grim darkness of the 41st millennium requires. They were created to defend humanity, yes, but they do so the way a fortress defends those within, hard, unyielding, and not particularly concerned if a few stones or lives crack in the process. To the angels of death, the ends nearly always justify the means. If an Astartes saves your life, it's because in that moment your life served the Emperor's plan. Not necessarily because he personally empathized with you. Some chapters like the Salamanders or Space Wolves may show flickers of genuine warmth or mercy, and those moments shine brightly against the dark backdrop of war. Other Marines like the Black Templars or Iron Hands won't bother with even a pretense of gentleness. They expect you to endure and obey, period. All of them, however, share a common trait. A relentless focus on victory and duty that leaves little room for the human softness we associate with heroism. For the average Imperial citizen, the best-case scenario is to never need the direct aid of Space Marines at all, to live under the shield of their distant vigil without being in the line of fire. If fate brings the Adeptus Astartes to your doorstep, it means you're already in dire straits. You will witness superhuman saviors battling horrors beyond imagination and perhaps be saved by their efforts. but you may also lose everything in the crossfire of gods at war. You might be awed by their dedication or horrified by their methods, likely both. One moment you'll cheer as an ultramarine dreadnought crushes the chaos warlord that enslaved your city. The next moment you'll tremble as he wordlessly marches past the starving survivors, offering no consolation, only a stern order to remain faithful and carry on. In this universe, salvation is often delivered with a blade and a bolter, not a comforting hug. The Space Marines are humanity's protectors, but they are not our friends or our caretakers. They stand above normal men and women in judgment and in defense. They embody the Imperium's paradox. To safeguard humanity, they have largely given up their own humanity. And so the civilians of the Imperium simultaneously revere and fear them. An Imperial citizen might drop to their knees in gratitude as the Angels of Death arrive, and later wake in cold sweat from nightmares about the blood-soaked giants they saw in battle. Both reactions are justified. In the grim darkness of the far future, being protected by a Space Marine is a bit like being protected by a chained attack dog, one that's been trained to kill without hesitation. You're glad it's on your side, but you pray you never find out what happens if the chain slips or if you accidentally draw its ire. The Space Marines will do whatever it takes to defeat the enemies of mankind. If that means saving a million souls, they will save them. If it means sacrificing a million souls, they will not hesitate to sacrifice them. To us, that duality is terrifying. To them, it's simply fulfilling their duty. And yet, despite it all, humanity needs the Space Marines. Without these brutal, fearless super soldiers, the Imperium would have fallen long ago, and trillions more innocents would have perished. It is a cruel bargain. We entrust our survival to warriors who can barely relate to us, hoping that in their calculated calculus, we are worth saving. They are our shield and our sword. If sometimes a blood-stained, unforgiving shield, and a sword that cuts us as well as our foes. As the saying goes, in the Emperor's name, we are blessed to be saved by the Space Marines and damned to live in a galaxy where such salvation is necessary.